Corsairs is a very special story. We have 9 Corsairs on the field right now. And tonight we're going to talk about not just the airplane, some of the people and the legacy that is left behind with some of the folks who fly these aircraft. Someone else who I want to thank, and I hope you will give me a round of applause when I tell you the story, is the men and women of VFA 32. These are the men and women who have the Super Hornet out there, the F-18, that on the right side actually has the names of Tom Hudner and Jesse Brown on it. Those folks just got off a deployment. They could have very easily sat out coming to this air show. They didn't get back, and I think until last Sunday. They found a crew of volunteers. They quick turned a jet out here and got that F-18 here because they knew what was going on in an effort to honor these 2 pilots who flew in Korea in the same squadron. So we have some of them here with us tonight. So a round of applause for VFA 32. Thank you. So another treat we have, just because EA likes to do that and just kind of pop stuff out, is about a couple months ago, I get a call from a gentleman who said, you know, you might want to really talk to my dad. My dad flew Corsairs in World War II and in Korea, and he's 101, still going strong, and we thought maybe you'd like to have him on stage a little bit when you guys are talking about the F4U. So we're going to talk a few minutes with him before we rotate to strictly the devotion programming, just because of the heat. So in a minute, I'm going to bring him out. I also want to call out, we have some books for sale. I'm an autograph, like I love collecting autographs. Those books are actually signed by Tom Hudner. So Adam Makos is willing to sign them as well here after the talk. So make sure you check that out as well. But most importantly, let's talk about some real stories of the legacies of those who flew the F4U. Starting with someone who actually flew the F4U. So ladies and gentlemen, a warm EA welcome to Colonel Joe McPhail.
Thank you. Yeah. All right, okay.
Thank you so much. Well, through Oshkosh, if someone would have told me I'd be sitting on stage with a real Corsair pilot from the war, I don't think I would have believed them. Yeah. And by the way, when you're out there, I also want to call out the owners and pilots and support crews of the Corsairs that brought those airplanes here. They worked very hard, long, and it wasn't cheap to get that many Corsairs in one place. So I want to make sure I call out those people because without them, we wouldn't have our flight line looking as good as it did out there today. Absolutely. So let me ask you a few questions. So overall, what did you think of the airplane, of the Corsair? What, did you like it?
Yes, sir, I sure did. It, you know, it had a lot of power, and it always brought me back home. So I thought it was great, good airplane.
While you were deployed, what squadrons were you with?
Well, the first time I went overseas in 43, I was in a Wildcat squadron, a Grumman Wildcat squadron. And, you know, we were in the Central Pacific below Tarawa, and really didn't see any action at all. But I had some nice experiences. I got to land that Wildcat in the middle of the Pacific Ocean with no power. Huh. And I was able to walk away from it. They called a PT boat. They came and picked me up. I was in the water only about 3 hours there. But it was an interesting experience for me, yeah.
So what was it like to transition from the Wildcat to the Corsair?
Well, it really wasn't a big deal. Had a lot more power than a Wildcat, and the Wildcat didn't have a hydraulic system, and you crank the gear up and you crank the gear down, and everything was kind of manual, even charging the guns. It was a cable that run out to the wing, and so, but when I got into Corsair, everything was hydraulic, and so it was pretty easy, yeah.
Well, when you watch the movie Devotion or you read the book, you know, it talks a lot about the difficulty seeing over the nose, landing. Was that yes. Something pretty tough to get over?
Yes, sir, it was, yeah. You know, even on the ground, you had to S-turn in order to see in front of you. And so it was hose nose, they called it, yeah.
So you fought in World War II.
And yes, sir.
Did you fly mostly air-to-air missions, or were they air-to-ground? What did you do?
Mostly air-to-ground, yeah. You know, especially even after we got into Korea, we were fighting the Chinese, and it was pretty tough going. A lot of cold weather and everything, too. Like I say, it brought me home every time, yeah.
Did you ever have to fly a Corsair with any combat damage or anything like that, or did you always?
No, sir, I never did. Yeah.
Oh, well, that's lucky.
You know, I tell people that, and they say you're probably flying so high they couldn't hit you. Yeah. we had to be down low, you know, to help the guys on the ground. Always had a kind of a fighter director of. Aviator on the ground that was helping the troops, you know. So it worked out good for me, yeah.
And maybe it's something you can answer. I had heard that on the Corsair you actually could use, is it the landing gear doors as a speed brake?
Well, what it was, it didn't, it put the gear down, but it didn't open the doors. And so you could use it kind of as a speed brake in a dive. The only time you would use that it would be if you were using rockets or something like that, pretty high. Yeah.
Wow. So you were always land based, correct?
Not all the time. I flew a little bit. In Korea, aboard the carrier, a CVE, a Jeep carrier, 600 feet long. And so when they didn't have any airplanes on the deck, well, you could use a deck takeoff, but most of the time they had airplanes at one end of the carrier, and so you had to use a catapult to take off, yeah.
I always wondered when you caught that wire and you touched down on the deck, how rough of a touchdown was that?
Well, it wasn't too bad. They would use that wire to pull you back, and when you qualified, and pull you back, and you'd take off again and come back around and got you six landings and to qualify you.
Wow.
And then the next day I flew my first mission, and I took off, and they taxied me over to the port cat, and they gave me the off brakes. When I sat there while I launched the guy from the right catapult, and I took off and came back. There was a big sign on the board said, "McPhail, a reluctant warrior." And I said, "What's the deal?" And they said, "You took off with your brakes on." I'm sure when I pushed the power up, I didn't want it to roll off the end. So I had to put the brakes on. But it didn't hurt anything, but they knew it happened.
So when you were flying close air support, can you tell us first, did you feel while you were doing those missions that close air support was a very important thing? Did you feel any?
Yes, sir. I did. I sure did. I think we really helped the troops on the ground. At that time, that was really important when they were fighting the Chinese. So I wanted to help them.
Whenever you would fly a standard mission supporting the troops, when you would go into to fire your ordnance, what altitude would you guys be flying? How high would you be?
Well, you know, the reservoir was pretty high, 5,000 or 6,000 feet, and so we'd naturally be up 500 feet above that to do most of the ordnance, machine guns and rockets and napalm, everything, yeah.
Wow. Was it hard to aim your rockets? Was that hard? Because they were unguided.
Well, it was, you didn't have a very good sight, on a rifle sight. You just kind of hit or miss, and you could do pretty good damage, though. Wow. You generally shoot two at a time, one off each wing, held 8 rockets,
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah.
And I love the fact, the Corsair was such a great airplane that it served through World War II, and they literally brought them back, for Korea to fill in, they didn't have enough sky raiders,
I think. Yes, right, it was. They started jets in Korea, but I didn't get a chance to fly them at all, yeah.
If you have a favorite airplane out of everything you flew, what would it have been?
It was the Corsair.
Was it?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Sure was, yeah.
Well, that's fantastic. Now, you were actually a member of the Black Sheep in Korea,
sir,
as well, right?
In Korea, 214. I was on a Jeep carrier called a Sicily, CVE-114, and, it was 600 feet long, and you couldn't do very much with any airplanes on the deck, but when they were all either in the hangar or in the air, you could land and the resting gear would pull you back and take off again. And so.
How was that acceleration on takeoff? Would that
be
kind of a kick, right?
Like I say, I took off with my brakes on, and it still worked. Yeah, still accelerated. Yeah.
Well, when you were out here today, you've spent a day with us, which is why we're not going to keep you too much longer here, because I want to respect your time and quest for air conditioning. How did it feel to see all those Corsairs out there together?
Well, it was kind of sentimental.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a favor of mine, no doubt about it.
Well, fantastic. Well, we're going to go ahead and transition. We'll let you go get some air conditioning.
Yeah.
But everybody, I just wanted to have a special little treat here for you. Round of applause for Colonel Joe McPhail.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's an honor to have you here.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Well, unhook me.
Well, he's a tough act to follow, so I'm not going to stay out here by myself too long. We are going to transition to talking about one specific squadron story and a group of friends, and that's a friendship and a bond that still lasts today. And of course, that the squadron is VF-32, the ship is the USS Leyte. So with us tonight, we have some people that are going to really help tell a great story for us. He couldn't be here in person, but virtually. I'm calling him my friend on TV right now, as I can kind of see him at the edge of the stage here. We have Tom Hudner III. And in person, we're going to bring them out now. We have Jamal Knight. Jamal is Jesse Brown's grandson. So a round of applause for Jamal.
You did.
You got to watch these Steelers fans. So,
Want me to stand?
I say you got to watch these Steelers fans. So, we also have with us tonight Adam Makos, who wrote the book Devotion, which became the movie and helped tell the story and bring the story to so many homes. So, ladies and gentlemen, Adam Makos. Thank you.
Good to see you, man.
And last but not least, as part of telling that legacy and getting it into the public hands, if you will, we have the lead pilot who actually shot all the filming scenes, the aerial coordinator, Kevin LaRosa II, who filmed Devotion. So, ladies and gentlemen, Kevin LaRosa II, or K2. Thank you. Absolutely, guys, have a seat. Joe McPhail's a little hard guy to follow.
Yeah, I don't say so.
So, you know, I think I want to start first with Jamal. Jamal, tell me, you know, a little bit about, you know, growing up. Was Jesse really talked about a lot in your house? What did you know about Jesse? You know, can you tell me about that?
Yeah, so at a very early age, I was told about my grandfather's exploits at that time, as some people would say, but told about childhood stories, stories when he was in high school, stories of how when he first got to Ohio State, stories of how he persevered to get into the Navy Reserve, and all of the things that he accomplished while he was in the Navy for that short time. So it was definitely a story that was told many times by many different people, including my grandmother, including his brothers, Lure and Fletcher, other friends that he either inspired as they were in lower grades below him when he was in high school, to getting them to attain, to be in dentistry, to be lawyers, teachers. He really, really inspired and was a true leader.
So for those who maybe are new to the story, or are unfamiliar, so Jesse Brown was this country's first African-American naval aviator. Think about that. You're talking late 1940s, that he was going through his flight training, what he had to face to get there. And, you know, luckily he gets to a squadron. And I think the remarkable part of the story is when he gets to VF-32, he got into a really good squadron of guys that were supportive, which could have easily not been the case when we're talking this time period.
That's correct. He had some run-ins early on, again, when he first attempted to join the Navy Reserve at Ohio State and was told that he would never, you know, fly a Navy plane. Even after he got past that, he made it to Pensacola, and there were a lot of disparaging things that were said and done, and he eventually was transferred to Jacksonville. And even there, when he qualified to get his gold wings, he was denied the penny.
Wow, that's unreal. And his background was he came from a family who did not have a lot. I mean,
yeah, family of sharecroppers.
Yeah.
They moved from farm to farm around Hattiesburg, Mississippi, and during those different times, he got the opportunity to make friends with the crop dusters. And was able to go out and at a point somewhere during this time, able to taxi out into the field and bring it back, but never to fly it at that point. But he was always fascinated with planes, even from an early age.
That, It's incredible. And now, at the same time, we go to another part of the United States, and we have Tom Hudner, who is tracking a career into to naval aviation as well. And, you know, Tom, were the exploits of your dad, you know, really well known growing up? Did you kind of know the war stories, or was it something he didn't really talk a lot about? Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, it was always certainly present. I mean, he would be the last to kind of proactively talk about those exploits, or certainly he was the last to, sing his own praises. But I certainly knew the details of his career, and you know, Jamal knows this, Adam knows this. I mean, Jesse's image has been, you know, burned into my brain from the time I was very young. I mean, so the relationship that they had and the bond that they shared was something that it was sort of part of my upbringing. And certainly because he was, you know, he lived a long life and he was recognized during his life, and we attended events and things like that, so it was certainly certainly present. And I would say I knew a lot of the details, but, and I've said this to Adam before, you know, the first time I read the book Devotion, you know, I said to Adam, it felt like it was a gift to me personally, because there were so many details of my father's story, of Jesse's story, of the men who fought on the ground of the Chosen, the men they served with, the families that I never knew about. So it was certainly eye-opening for me to learn so much about, you know, my dad's own story and experience, and those of Jesse and the families and the men they served with.
Thank you, Tom. So I guess I would like to, I guess I'd like to ask Adam, you know, when did you first become aware of this story? You know, tell us a little bit about your past as well as how you got interested in telling the stories of our veterans.
Well, Chris, I was lucky. I had two grandfathers who served at the tail end of World War II, so they didn't see terrible things. So for them, their heroes were guys like Joe Foss and Pappy Boyington. And so I was lucky. We got to go to air shows together in museums, and they passed on that love at an early age. Where I discovered Tom Hudner's story, I was a young journalist. We were publishing our own magazine about veterans' stories. And I was in Washington, D.C., 2007. So I think we're talking now 15 years from that point to this one. And I saw Captain Tom Hudner give a speech, and when it came time to go home, I saw him in the lobby of the hotel. And for me, it was like seeing one of the Beatles or one of the Rolling Stones sitting there, in this case, reading his newspaper, but completely unknown by the people around him. And I thought, this is that guy who crash-landed his plane to save a friend. But there was a hesitancy. Even though I wanted to talk to him, I wanted to interview him, I said, wait a second, I know World War II, but I don't know the Korean War. The Korean War, up till this movie was made, had very little legacy. I mean, MASH was the legacy of the Korean War. The last Korean War movie was Porkchop Hill, 1956. That was starring Gregory Peck. So it's been a little while. I went up to him anyway, and he gave me that business card, and it changed my life. And we became friends, and I came to know that Tom Hudner, the Medal of Honor recipient, didn't see himself as a hero. He said something that was very powerful to me once. He said, you got to understand, we don't wear the medal for ourselves. We wear this for all those who served and who may have done brave acts that never came to the forefront. The guys who may have deserved a Medal of Honor but died in action or disappeared and were never found again. And so for him, this medal had a weight. It wasn't just a ticket to stardom. It was a responsibility. And he took that responsibility into the book and gave me more than a decade of his life.
Can you tell me a little bit about the research you did for the book? You know, who did you talk to? I know your dad worked with you on it. Can you tell me a little bit about that research?
It was an exhaustive process, because there really weren't other books you could pick up and kind of get a primer from. We were starting from scratch. What is VF-32? Oh, wait, they went to the Mediterranean. Tom told me a story once that was amazing. He said, yeah, one time I gambled with Elizabeth Taylor. I said, wait a second, Elizabeth Taylor? He said, yeah, we met her on shore leave and da-da-da. And the story goes that he was playing with one of his last, must have been a poker chip or a chip for roulette, and he was flipping it, and he dropped it right down, almost down the back of her dress, but it slid down the back and landed on her seat. And he needed that chip, and so he looked at it and looked at it, and eventually he saw this moment where she moved forward, and he darted his hand down, and he grabbed that chip, and she kind of caught him, and she kind of smiled, and he said, when he was telling me the story, he said, oh God, she must have thought I was trying to grope her. But really, he needed that chip. And I said to him, you know, after I heard all the stories about him and Elizabeth Taylor, I said, you know, you really could have been her second husband. But Tom was the kind of guy who didn't know how good looking he was. He didn't know how cool he was. But that was the fun part of the research. The craziest part was going to North Korea. So I've always believed that to write a story properly, if you're writing about the German Luftwaffe battling American fighters over Sicily, you gotta go to Sicily. If you're writing about Germany, if you're writing about the Blitz in England. And so in this case, we took it to an extreme. And I got to that part in the book where Tom Hudner says to Jesse Brown, we'll come back for you. And I called him up the next morning. I was writing it and I said, Tom, did you ever make it back to North Korea? And he said, no, your journey doesn't take you there as a military officer. I said, well, would you go if we could get you there? Needless to say, we pulled some strings. We found some people who do some work there in a covert sense. They connected us to people who do things in a legitimate sense. And next thing you know, we're on a plane. Tom Hudner is 88 years old, and he steps off the plane in North Korea. You surrender your passport. You are at their mercy. And that's how far we went to research the book, and that's how far he went to complete his journey, and that was to try to get Jesse Brown home. And during that visit, we received an incredible message from Kim Jong-un. As I've said before, the North Korean officers lined up across from us at the table, and they said, we have a message for you from the marshal, the supreme leader. And I thought, oh, great, you know, 1 year imprisonment, hard labor, you know, gruel diet. I should have listened to my mom, never came here. and they said instead, Captain Hudner, Kim Jong-un admires your dedication and the promise you've kept to your friend, and that you've come so far after so long for him. And they said, he pledges the Korean People's Army will help you in your mission of finding Jesse Brown. So we came close. We couldn't get to the crash site that time. But that's how far Tom's devotion to his wingmen went. That's how far the research went. December 4th, 1950 was one of the darkest days in American military history for a lot of reasons. There were 20,000 US Marines and Army soldiers and about 200 British commandos surrounded by 120,000 Chinese troops. They were fighting for their lives at the Chosin Reservoir, which was about 30 miles from the border between North Korea and China. Our country thought the war was going to be won by Christmas, we'd all be home, and instead the Chinese pulled this ambush. You see, they didn't want a democracy on their border, and we were that close to making North Korea a democratic country, a unified country. And so they launched this ambush, our guys were surrounded, and Jesse Brown and Tom Hudner were flying, it was called a road recon. And I'll wait for that. They were flying road recon that day. And road recon was to look for the Chinese troops who would hide out during the daylight and come out at night and attack. And so the Chinese were known for hiding in mine shafts, in forests, anywhere they could camouflage themselves. But to find them, it required the pilots, the aviators, to fly down. You know, we're talking 75 feet above the ground to get really low and to look in those nooks and crannies. And that's when maybe 10 miles northwest of the Chosin Reservoir, Jesse Brown's plane was hit by an unseen bullet. The Chinese were known for firing, they didn't bring anti-aircraft into the Chosin Reservoir. That was one of their great weaknesses. But they had manpower. We had the Corsairs, and we had Marines like Joe, and Navy pilots like Tom and Jesse. They had the ability to put 1,000 rifles and to aim into the sky at the same time. And that's what they did. And so Jesse Brown was shot down behind enemy lines, and that's when Tom Hudner did something that had never been done before. It has never been attempted since. he made a carrier landing on a mountaintop, wheels up, intentional crash landing, putting himself behind enemy lines in freezing temperatures with really no promise of escape. You know, in the movie, they show the helicopter and it comes pretty quickly to get him. There were 2,000 wounded Marines at Hagaru Re, that base. There were two helicopters to bring those guys out to safety. And so the odds that a helicopter would even come for Tom, they were pretty slim. So he put himself in this incredible position and tried to save his friend. And it was the ultimate definition of devotion. Tom thought he would be court-martialed for this. And I don't want to go on too long. I need to share the stage with my friends. But what happened there's a scene in the movie. It was the Yalu Bridge Raid. And it's where the Corsairs and the Sky Raiders went to knock down the bridges where the Chinese were, that they were using to infiltrate the country. So during the Yalu Bridge Raid, which was about 2 weeks before this incredible incident, December 4th, one of the American pilots was shot down. He was a Sky Raider pilot named Roland Batson. And Batson crashed in a cornfield. And all of his buddies who were flying home from this bridge raid looked down and they saw Batson get out of his Sky Raider and wave at them. Well, they continued on their way. They were told, oh, search and rescue, we'll send a helicopter, we'll get him out, don't worry. Batson was never seen again. He hasn't been seen to this day. And even back then, when the men heard this, they said, why didn't somebody just land and pick him up? It was a field. And that's when the skipper of VF-32 said to all of his pilots, if any of you attempt a stunt like that, I'll court-martial your ass. He said, it's bad enough to lose one aircraft, one pilot. We don't need to lose two. And so that day, December 4th, when Tom made this intentional landing to try to save his friend, he thought his Navy career was going to end.
Wow, that's incredible. Can you imagine putting yourself in the shoes of both of those pilots, flying close air support for troops on the ground? One goes down and you're in a good running airplane, you can go home and you choose not to. And as you mentioned, it's small arms fire, which means you're not talking about something fired from miles away. It's the enemy's close, you know, to where you all are. That's incredible.
And Chris, I should add that Tom thought he was going to get court-martialed. Instead, the captain of his carrier, when he came back, he said, there has been no finer act of unselfish heroism in military history. And he said, I've recommended you for the Medal of Honor. So that was December 7th, the day Tom got back to that ship. They were waiting for him with open arms.
So shortly after that, after you write the book, what year did you write the book?
The book came out in 2015.
Okay, so 2015. When does the movie happen? How does that come about?
That, you know, everybody, I've been asked by so many fellow authors, how did you get this movie made? And, you know, all I can think of is we have a couple guardian angels up there because the stars have to align in such an incredible way for it to happen. The way Devotion really came about as a film, the book rights were with a big producer in Hollywood. He had made Captain Phillips and Moneyball, and he had made the 50 Shades of Grey trilogy. I mean, this guy's making big, big movies. But it wasn't moving forward. It just wasn't going, it didn't feel right. And one day, Glenn Powell contacts me. And I looked him up, and I said, okay, Glenn Powell, what's he been in? And it was long before Top Gun Maverick. And Glenn said, I want to play Tom Hudner, and I want to option this book, and I want to get this movie made. I thought, okay, that's not going to happen, because you are an actor, and we don't do that. But I said, you know what, this guy looks like a good guy. Maybe he could play Tom Hudner. Because to me, Tom was just, he was a prince of a guy. I mean, he was a gentleman of gentlemen. So I said to Glenn, I decided to test him. I said, would you like to meet the real guy? And if he said, well, yeah, sure, but later, next summer, next spring, if we get it going. Instead, he said, when and where? I said, well, how about next week? He said, I'm there. And next thing you know, Glenn and I are sitting down at the Hudner family dinner table, and Tom's wife, Georgia, is cooking waffles in the kitchen. And I got to see these two interact, and I said to myself at that moment, this guy is meant to play Tom, because they had that same level of decency. Really not knowing how we would ever get $90 million to make a movie. How is this guy going to do it? And that night we went to dinner, and he said, I know the people who can get this made. He said, Rachel Smith and Molly Smith are producers in Hollywood. They're the daughters of Fred Smith, founder of Federal Express. And the reason that's so important is that Fred Smith is one of our country's really great patriots. He, not a lot of people know, he came out of Yale and he went right to Vietnam as an officer. He served in K-35, a rifle company that had terrible attrition. He lost two of his four platoon leaders here in the Silver Star, the Bronze Star, two Purple Hearts. And he doesn't tell anybody about it. Comes back and he forms this incredible company, but he knew what it was to serve. And he knew how powerful this story was. And when it came time to get this made, when the rubber meets the road, you have to find either a studio executive who's willing to outlay that big chunk of money and maybe lose their job over it, or you have to go the private equity route. And in this case, Mr. Smith said, if no one else will do it, I will. And he wrote the check with a lot of zeros.
That's fantastic. Kudos to him.
Kudos to him.
So, Jamal, when do you and Jessica kind of become aware that this is happening, that Jesse's legacy is going to be, you know, first off, I'm sure you read the book
yes.
when it came out. And when did you first hear that there was a movie coming out about it?
I'm trying to think exactly when. I think, Adam, it may have been 2017, 2018, meeting up in, was that... Tom, was that when we came to Bath, when they started working on the destroyer?
Yeah, I think, well, see, that sort of painful meeting with Adam and Lynn Powell and my parents was Memorial Day 2017.
So that was sort of my first kind of introduction to what became this odyssey. So yeah. Jamal, I'm sure, was
yeah,
right,
so I'm thinking
right
around
that
time frame.
And I think, too, Jamal, you'd probably agree. I mean, for us, it was still, as family members, it was still... sort of abstract. It was exciting, the prospect of it, but there were so many unknowns, obviously. But it was, you know, we also, I think, knew enough, what little, at least I know about Hollywood, I knew enough to know that it's a lot still needed to happen for a movie to actually be made. So the fact that we ended up where we are is quite incredible.
Wow. Yeah, I agree.
You know, and it's interesting because we're talking kind of about three different things. We're talking about the real events, we're talking about the book, and we're talking about the movie, but all of it really plays a hand in keeping those stories going forward. You know, without one of, you know, obviously without the real events, but I think our museum and our story, which we'll get to in a little bit, is a great example of how the book, the movie, anytime you get a chance to put these real stories in the hands of the public and maybe make them aware of something that they had no idea happened before is important. We're an aviation museum who is aware of this stuff, and even we didn't understand at least one important artifact that we were looking at. We can talk about that here toward the end of the night. You know, Tom, you had a lot of time, I'm sure not enough, as you would agree, to spend with your dad and get to know him and your family. You know, Jamal, you and your wonderful family, do you feel that this helps keep, you know, Jesse's legacy going and his story going?
Definitely. You know, we talk about it a lot, along with my mother, my sister, and other family members, that, you know, this was definitely a blessing that we truly embrace to continue the story about Jesse Leroy Brown.
That's fantastic. And today, if anybody was watching, your two daughters and son helped start and shut down our course there today.
Yeah, that was great. I enjoyed it, and I know they enjoyed it as well.
Well, and for us, that's where the rubber meets the road, is getting, you know, people out there involved in it, learning their own family history. You guys obviously know your family history, but yeah. You know, we've had a lot of people come out and see a B-17 or B-25 or something like that, who maybe just knew my grandpa was on one and I'd never seen one. So, right. You know, that's a good question. The first time you ever saw a Corsair in person, both of you, Tom and Jamal, you know, what were your thoughts? Did you kind of think, did you think of your relatives, or was there any sort of emotion in that?
I guess so the first time I ever, and I'm looking at Kevin here, I don't know if you can see me looking at him, but I'm looking at him. And the first time I, so obviously I'd seen Corsairs up close, I'd seen them in flight, you know, not often, but occasionally through my life. But the first time I sat in the cockpit of a Corsair was with Kevin and his team when I visited set. That was down in Statesboro where they were filming the carrier, you know, the Leyte scenes. And so credit to Kevin and his team, I got to climb up and get inside the cockpit of a Corsair, which was a, you know, absolutely completely surreal experience for me. And again, you know, in my mind, that, you know, that was my dad's office, that was his workplace. And so to be able to, you know, sit there and get a sense of what his surroundings were like, and you know, the technical skill that those pilots had to gain and utilize every day, and the complexity of, you know, of the cockpit and the controls, and you know, the view out that you know, out that cockpit, and to get a sense of, you know, again, the wings, the long fuselage, etc., was just an incredible experience, and to be up so close and watching these guys, Kevin and team, filming those scenes. And just, I remember driving, actually with my niece, driving toward the set. We were still a few miles away, and we were just watching Corsairs flying overhead, back and forth, doing these runs. And, you know, for me, it felt like, gosh, this was what it must have felt like during Korea or World War II, seeing these aircraft in flight, you know, on a regular basis. And then to, you know, actually get to the airfield and see them up close was just a completely surreal experience for me.
Wow. How about you, Jamal? What was your first time getting up close and personal, and how did you feel looking at a Corsair?
Well, I have a two-part answer. So there was always a Corsair F4U in my grandmother's home, as far as I can remember. Actually, I have that Corsair now in my home. So I've always seen that, but there was a run, I believe it was in summer of 2012, and I was invited to go to Midland for the Ghost Squadron, where they were inducting my grandfather. And I was able to get in one there, and then they introduced me to an owner pilot that was gonna be down in Houston for the air show, and I was able to get my entire family into the cockpit and see the pedals. And as Tom stated, you know, looking out that front nose and canopy there, and just feeling and taking it all in, because I'm looking at foot pedals and all of these manual controls, and in my mind thinking of the processing speed that he's having to make decisions, and that would get me, you know, it would, you know, start thumping with some emotions, because I knew that he wanted to be an engineer, and he inspired me, and I became an engineer, and I know that he was thinking so fast that he was able to become that pilot from, you know, the humble beginnings that he had.
Absolutely, that's amazing to hear that there's just always been a Corsair around your house. Yeah. That is super cool. So on the flip side, we're talking about filming, and Kevin, can you tell me a little bit about when you first became aware of the movie? How did they approach you, and what were some of the challenges of doing this?
Yeah, absolutely. My first phone call of devotion was actually from Glenn Powell. I just finished up Top Gun Maverick with Glenn. We'd become pretty good friends, and I got a call from him one day, and he said, "Kev, do you want to do another Navy movie?" And I said, "Yes, yeah, sign me up." And he said, "Well, this is very different. This is going to be a period movie, Korean War movie, and I need you to come to Hollywood. I want to introduce you to Molly and Rachel Smith. They're going to be the producers in Black Label Media. And I want to talk to them about how we did Top Gun, because we want Devotion to have real planes and real flying and period correct aircraft, the correct paint jobs, the correct loadouts, so that when we watch this movie, we can do it some justice with authenticity and realism." And that's music to my ears. That's what we love doing. We turn storyboards into reality. So that was my first call, and that got me pretty amped and excited. And then going in to actually talk to Molly and Rachel Smith, they had the same, you know, the electric energy about this movie, and then getting to learn about you and the story behind it. This felt very different than Top Gun Maverick. This was a real story. So everybody that I got to bring in, and that's part of my job as the aerial coordinator of Devotion, is I get to kind of handpick my team, and we get to bring in the right aircraft. And of course, they're here today. And one of my first calls was to our good friend Steve Hinton of Planes of Fame. Worked on tons of movies and TV shows with him and his son, and they're just fantastic people. And that's kind of what we do. We handpick our team. I'm a civilian, but it's almost like you're going to war, and you want to do that with somebody that you trust. You know, on a personal level, you're going to be in close formation, and we speak the same kind of camera language, if you will. So that was my first call, and I didn't hesitate a beat. It was definitely clear the schedule and hop on this project, because it was going to be incredible.
So you fly an amazing piece of hardware, the Cinejet. And what were some of the challenges of trying to fly the Cinejet alongside the Corsairs for the filming?
You know, conversely to challenges, it was actually a much better movie for the L-39 Albatross, which we affectionately trademarked it as the Cinejet. When we did Maverick, obviously that was difficult. It's a slower, underpowered airplane, but it ended up being a great tool, a perfect camera platform for chasing the Corsairs. It was much evenly matched, so it was actually easier. One of the challenges is J.D. Dillard, our incredible director for Devotion. He's very particular, which I love, and when we sat down and we were storyboarding this movie, he would hand draw images and show us exactly what he dreamt for this movie, of how he wanted to tell the story. And one shot I remember is he wanted, you know, the props, the intakes, you know, these massive radial motors right in the audience's face. And if you've seen the movie or you're going to see it, you'll see multiple sequences where you have a face full of airplane. And typically that's been a very difficult shot to get, because we either see jet exhaust or we see our own wingtips or our tail planes. So what we did is we built a tail cam on the back of the L-39 right above the jet exhaust, and it was a fixed position camera, and it allowed the Corsairs and the Sky Raiders to tuck up, you know, mere feet behind the L-39 to get those shots. So the L-39 was a great platform. We used it extensively. We also flew the Airbus H-125 helicopter throughout the movie as well. And we built 7 camera positions on the Corsair. So when you watch the movie and you're riding along for those sequences, you're really attached to the aircraft. And that was part of the recipe of ground photography, helicopter, jet, and mounted cameras.
So we're talking about mounted cameras. Just a couple nights ago, you told a great story about the Dog Bowl cover. Can you tell that story?
Yeah, absolutely. We call that the Dog Bowl cam now. So this is a J.D. Dillard, and our DP, Eric Messerschmidt, also dreamt up this camera position. If you watch the movie, you're going to notice a camera position that just doesn't seem realistic. It doesn't seem possible. And it's behind and underneath the F4U Corsair. Now, there's no structure there. So we hired amazing fabricators that attached a metal frame to the back of the aircraft, dropped it down about 1.5 feet and aft of the aircraft. So when you are looking at this camera position, you're seeing an aircraft from below and behind. And the purpose of that is to create energy. It's to allow, you know, trees and rocks to go ripping by. It looks like Mach 1. The closer we are to the ground and the closer that camera is to the ground, the more energy we're going to have. So that's what that was for. So we built up this great camera, and we started doing these river runs with it in this movie, Jesse's River Run in 211. It's a very, you know, special part of the movie. And in this, Steve Hinton Sr. and Mike Oliver, they were flying these Corsairs. We realized right away that the Corsair would completely fog out this camera with oil. It would just come back, and the image was all blurry, and the camera body was just covered in aircraft oil. And the Corsair was doing what it was supposed to do, the 2800, they blow oil. So as any team does, we started going to work to figure out how to overcome that. And a true testament to our fabricators, they were walking into a Petco store, and they were on an aisle, and they saw some camping supplies for, I guess, your dog. And there were these rubber dog bowls. And they were like, man, well, that's like the perfect size for the lens. So they bought a couple, brought it to the airport, and sure enough, it fit right on there. Well, that's pretty cool. Now we can protect the lens from oil. Well, how do we get it off when we get to the river? And we devised a system. Our great mechanics and engineers and pilots was basically a bicycle cable run all the way from this dog bowl all the way through the fuselage into the cockpit. And we'd get out there on the river run, and it would basically be the funniest thing I've ever seen. I'd be next to them, and I'd say, okay, guys, we're here. go ahead and yank the dog bowl, and you'd see the pilots in the Corsair pulling this bicycle cable. And sure enough, that thing would rip off the lens, and it would give us about a minute and a half to get that shot. So a couple sorties, if you'd imagine, getting out there. But that river run sequence, when you watch it, that's the dog bowl cam, and that was how we overcame it, and it gave us just enough time to get the shot.
It's incredible. And it's a key part of the movie. Hopefully the crowd here has seen the movie. But wonderful film, and the air-to-air photography is just beautiful. I mean, that is just a fantastic piece of
I appreciate it. I mean, for the airplane fanatics here, I mean, we have, I think there's 9 Corsairs here, and people always ask this. Our job was to bring in period-correct aircraft, but you'll notice in this movie we had a couple Dash 1s, and I learned a little bit about Corsairs. I'm not a Corsair pilot. I certainly wish I could be, but we had 2 Dash 4s, which was proper Korean War aircraft, so we're talking 4-bladed props, a little bit different. And then we had 2 Dash 1s in the movie. Now, when we pick aircraft, we pick them based on, are they available? What's the insurance like on them? Who can fly them? And that's kind of the aircraft we ended up with on the movie. It's sometimes they're budgetary constraints where they're geographically located. And what we did in the movie is we would hide the Dash 1s a little bit. So when you watch the movie, if you look really closely in the back of formations or in the back of aircraft carriers, the Dash 1s are usually hidden. Those are the World War II era aircraft. And then those Dash 4s are kind of front and center. So in the movie, we also it was pretty intricate. We hired painters to come in with movie paint. And believe it or not, the movie paint is a mixture of like floor wax and whiskey and some other things, but it works out really good. We painted these things to be VF-32. And we went to great lengths. We had historians from the Tailhook Society, the Navy Tailhook Society, giving us images. And we painted Thomas Hudner's airplane as 205 for the side number. Tried to do proper bureau numbers and all the correct markings. We had 211 for Jesse. We had a 203 out there. And we even weathered the aircraft. We wanted to make sure when the viewers watched this movie that they didn't look like they just rolled off the assembly line. We literally put massive, you know, stripes down the aircraft for exhaust as if they'd been out on missions over and over. We'd put, you know, paint that was chipping off. So we went to great lengths to make sure that the airplanes look good on film. Even the ordnance would drop tanks and missiles. So that was a lot of fun, and it ended up looking pretty good.
So, and at one point, you actually built a chunk of an aircraft carrier, correct?
A giant chunk of an aircraft carrier. So we shut down a runway at the Statesboro Airport, which is in basically Savannah, Georgia. And we built a full-size aircraft carrier on that runway. And it was a superstructure off to the one side, and we had put a coating on the runway. This was the best way we can shoot this stuff practically. We had airplanes departing on this carrier deck, which was a runway. We had airplanes landing on it. The only thing we didn't do is trap, you know, real live traps with Corsairs. And believe me, the pilots wanted to do it. Even the owners of the airplane, it was the insurance companies that were like, all right, time out here. We're not going to be doing that. But it was incredible. I mean, there were days out on in the fog in the morning where we would tow the Corsairs out to our carrier where you couldn't see anything out past the fields. And the night lighting on this fake carrier was on, and it felt like we were at sea sometimes. It was just too much fun. Looked cool.
And it carries across on the movie really good.
Thanks. That's
fantastic. Now, did Jamal and Tom, did you guys both get to visit the aircraft carrier set? I know you guys visited the set more than one time, and where did you guys go?
Well, I'm constantly reminded that Jamal definitely visited the set because he's in the dang trailer in his cameo. So when I've watched the trailer 800 times, I've seen Jamal front and center 800 times. But his cameo, I know, and actually Adam's took place on the carrier set. I was able to visit the carrier set as well. My own cameo came at a different set in a different scene. But I would say, just from my experience, again, it was incredible. And as Kevin just said, I mean, they built a full scale aircraft carrier superstructure. I actually found a photo of the USS Leyte with Corsairs on the deck from the Korean War, and I did a split screen side by side, a particular angle of that set in Statesboro with this shot from the Korean War. And I mean, it was literally, you know, identical. And sort of the additional movie magic that they were able to create to you know, make it look like they were out in, you know, in the middle of the ocean was pretty cool as well. But to visit that set to walk on and around that sort of carrier set and the superstructure, and then again to see the aircraft taking off, landing, taxiing, and to watch the choreography of Kevin and his team was just so eye-opening for me, obviously as a non-movie, non-Hollywood person, but just to see their work and their coordination and collaboration and expertise. And I guess just quickly, since I have the mic, I would just say that Kevin, you know, when, I mean, all, as a family member, I would say that it really felt like the stars were aligning when this team came together to create this movie. You know, Adam, you know, after Dad and Jesse, Adam really got this this journey started by writing the book. And then as, you know, Kevin mentioned J.D. Dillard, Glenn Powell, Jonathan Majors playing Jesse. And then, you know, when Kevin and his team came on board, and I had already been geeking out, you know, watching the early trailers for Top Gun Maverick. And so I thought, if this is the guy and this is the team that is going to be filming Devotion, filming the aerial scenes in Devotion, again, I felt like a very lucky family member. And again, I think the final product, while I admit my slight bias, I think it's just phenomenal. So I just, I started referring to them as a dream team early on, you know, again, directors, producers, everyone involved, just really the best of the best. And I'm really just so grateful to all of them. I'll stop rambling now, sorry.
Not at all. That's why you're here with us, virtually. So, Jamal, what did you think when you had a chance to visit the set?
I'd always wanted to visit a set, didn't really know anything about it, got there, saw the superstructure, saw the blue screen behind it as well. And as Tom mentioned, I didn't get an opportunity to see Kevin do his work, but seeing JD run Glenn and Jonathan through, you know, their marks as far as, you know, when they're doing their qualification times to run out and do everything, you know, let's do it again. And I was like, wow. And, you know, they're doing it 10, 15 times. And then getting an opportunity as an extra, I wasn't understanding that we're going to do it 10, 15 times. And so my issue was is that a 1940s version of a 12 is not a 2022 version of a 12. And so my feet started hurting. And so I was just telling the guys who were being paid extras, come on, let's finish this up. But I had a great time. It was a great experience. Explained to my family members when I got back and told them I was in the movie, and the running joke is, okay, so what's your character name? And I said, I think I'm Black Sailor number 6. But I had a great time. It was a great experience, and just to see the different dynamics that went into producing, filming, acting in a big time movie.
So Kevin, let me ask you, you know, you've worked on a lot of different production pieces now, a lot of different movies. When you were doing this, did you feel that this one was going to be special? Could you feel that? Was it palpable?
Yeah, I mean, we knew it was going to be special from the start. I can tell you there were moments when Tom and other members of the family would visit on set. And Tom would come over, you know, to the aerial department, you know, and we've been getting airplanes prepped and pre-flighted all day, and we're moving around the carrier, and we'd have a little break, and Tom would say, you want to see my dad's logbook? And that would really just remove us, right, from, okay, we're making a movie, wait a minute, this is real. Like, we're standing next to 205, which is portraying his dad's aircraft, and now we're looking at this logbook. We're reading line entries, right? And there's a line entry, which I remember, I won't remember it word for word, but it gave our team chills because it's the line entry of Tom Hudner's final mission. And it dictates in there that he landed behind enemy lines in an effort to save Vincent Brown. And then in a different color pen, after that line, it says unsuccessful. And you can tell he wrote that at a later day. It gives me chills just thinking about it right now. So for the aerial team, for the Steve Hintons and the John Maloney's and even my dad who joined me on set to help, when we were looking at stuff like that, it instantly just honed us in and went, wow, the gravity of what we're doing here, this really happened. This isn't just Hollywood. We're trying to tell a true story. So Tom, thank you for doing that, because that was very inspiring to our team, and I felt like it'd be a real big driving force every time we got to see stuff like that.
Well, and it was fun in this day and age of social media where you know, everything kind of comes out. When you guys were filming, you know, people who would be out at airports would film Corsairs. You know, hey, they're filming a movie, there's Corsairs flying around. You know, you'd see the Corsair getting chased by the Cinejet, and pretty unique formation. And I always say it, and I mean it. I blame everybody on this stage and calling in tonight for this. We have a Corsair in our museum, Corsair 259. And during COVID, you know, everybody was kind of looking for something to do, and we were all locked down. And on staff here, we said, you know, what if every museum has an artifact that has stories that grows legs, you know, and the next thing you know, it's like, this is Hitler's canoe or something. And you're like, what is that? So we're always like, okay, let's get the real stories out. Let's get the stories out to the signs and to our docents and, you know, make sure we're being factual. And we said, you know, this could be kind of fun. Let's take on some of these wild stories and let's just see what shakes out. Let's see what's real, what's not, and we'll learn some more stuff about our airplanes and artifacts. So we started, we were looking to start, we had just done a Huey exhibit in the museum, so we did the Huey, and all of your filming posts and everything was out, you know, and it was, you know, here's these formations, and we said, you know, Corsairs are kind of topical, we should run something about the Corsair, why don't we do our F4U next? I knew it was built too late for World War II, and I had heard that it had been on the Bunker Hill during Korea, so we looked up everything we could find on the Bunker Hill looking for 259, and we found nothing. And there's a good reason for that, is because 259 was never on the Bunker Hill. So we just kind of wasted a lot of time, but we have a lot of great Bunker Hill photos now. So we found a logbook. It was jammed in the back of a filing cabinet, and here it was, the Corsair's logbook that tracked it all the way back to its acceptance flight into the Navy out of Stratford, Connecticut, with Chance Fott. So we kind of start looking through it, and we're like, wow, there's really nothing too crazy here. You know, as we're flipping pages, it goes into storage. And I'll never forget, I had just gotten done reading Devotion, and I flip a page, and me and Ben were sitting there, and we just said, hey, look at that. And it was just a simple line. It said, replacement airplane from Fazron 2 to VF-32, and it was picked up by Marty Good. And I'm sitting there, and I'm like, M. Good, like, could there have been more than one M. Good in VF-32? And we're just kind of looking at each other, and we're like, this is the squadron that Jesse Brown and Tom Hudner were in. Like, that's really cool. We knew the date, so we're like, well, it was after the date of the mission, the December 4th mission. And then we flipped another page, and the next page, near the top of the page, is Tom Hudner. And it's just him going out flying the airplane. And, you know, right away, we start seeing lines that say, you know, we had, you know, Savoli and like I said, Good, Fowler, Wilkinson, all in this logbook. So as a museum guy, the first thing I always tell everybody is, if you think you have Babe Ruth's bat, you better go make sure you have Babe Ruth's bat before you say anything. And I have a friend, John Anderson, who was working on the set, and I said, John, do you know anybody that we could talk to about this? And he's like, well, I know Adam Makos and Tom Hudner. Would that work? And I'm like, yeah, perfect, you know. So, and I remember reaching out to you, and you were like, no way. Like, that was like the first email I got back. And we cross-referenced our logbook with Tom's logbook, and it all matched. And we actually did the same thing with Francesca with Marty Good's logbook, and everything matched. It was, this is a real VF-32 Corsair. It was a replacement airplane for one of the ones lost on the December 4th mission. This served after Jesse and Tom were together. But Tom did fly it. All of his friends flew this airplane. So John Hopkins, who had restored this airplane back in the late 80s, was very proud of this airplane, very proud of the paint that he had applied to this airplane. But John's a true artist, and I had to approach John and say, so we want to strip all the paint
off of your Corsair, and we want to repaint it, but back into its original real paint scheme. Its real identity is 209. 209 is actually written on the logbook. They actually wrote it in there that this is nose number 209 in VF32. But if it wasn't for this movie and it wasn't for the book, first off, I wouldn't call everybody here a friend. That's probably most important to me personally. But we wouldn't be here tonight. We wouldn't be here tonight talking about Jesse and Tom and that legacy. And I think you all should be very proud of that. We're very proud of our Corsair. If you're out on the grounds, if you didn't see it yet, it's 209 out there. And something that really blew me away, again, not only the dedication to get their jet here, but those of VFA 32 who really stepped up when they didn't have to and got that jet here. And when it rolls in, I had no idea, maybe others did, that it had Tom and Jesse's name painted on the right side of the aircraft. That blew me away. Thank you guys for spearheading that, for sparking that conversation that at least got one museum and one piece of history sort of back on track, if you will.
Chris, can I just mention, I still remember the, I believe it was a text from Adam that said, Tom, can you look in your dad's logbook for Euro number 97259? And so I did, found several entries, replied back. I said, yeah, I found it on these dates, you know, number of different missions. Why do you ask? And he said, well, the EAA Museum in Oshkosh, Wisconsin has just discovered that they have that plane in their collection. And then I believe it was Adam sent the screenshot that perhaps you had sent of that plane's logbook. So there I am. I mean, I'm holding Dad's logbook right here. You know, April 10th, 1951, Bureau number 97259, and then the entry that you had, you know, April 10th, 1951, pilot Hudner. So again, one more surreal, incredible experience in this odyssey, this journey that we've been on. And then I know, you know, again, Jamal and I were able to sit in the cockpit of that plane when we visited the museum sometime back after, you know, when the new display was being dedicated. And again, back to the notion of being surreal, to sit in that cockpit and actually hold the controls that Dad actually held to a plane that he flew in combat in Korea was a fairly mind-blowing experience. So, Chris, I'm grateful to you for helping make that possible.
Well, thank you. It's a team effort, as everybody involved here. A couple fun stories I'll tell you guys that I don't think I ever told you about the exhibit. If you get a chance, come back when the museum is not, it's not AirVenture, because the museum's kind of put together a little bit differently. We didn't just do the Corsair. We wanted to do something more, and we built an exhibit that's around the airplane that tells about not just Jesse and Tom and VF-32, but also Korea, which, as we said earlier, doesn't get talked about enough. I truly think if it wasn't for MASH, a lot of people would have forgotten, you know, totally about Korea. But, you know, we're getting that back in front of young kids' faces. This event happened, and these two friends did the hard thing, even the right thing, even though it was hard. And that kind of progresses throughout the story of our airplane. I mean, you know, even our EAA leadership, the easy thing would have been like, no, just keep the airplane, leave it alone, put some signage around it. And it was, no, we're going to do, you know, the right thing, even though it's harder. And I'm really grateful that John Hopkins didn't have anything heavy. He didn't throw anything at me when I told him I was going to strip the paint off his Corsair. But we're very proud of that airplane. You guys actually came and cut the ribbon. Couple fun stories about building that exhibit that I didn't tell you. We were working like right into the night before you guys got to see that airplane. And a construction that was going on nearby had created some dust. So we were up early that morning cleaning dust. And luckily we moved the airplane in right after that, so we didn't get dust on it. When you got in the airplane, emotions hit you a bit, and you said it's getting dusty it's dusty in here. We all freaked out because we're like, did dust actually get into the airplane? Like, we thought we had totally missed. We're like, man, we should have vacuumed it out or something. We didn't know it got in there. So that was a fun part of the story. The other part is John Anderson from the set said, you know, would you like something from the film to put into the movie? And, you know, we think we needed to do that. You know, we needed to preserve. We love telling the story of of telling the story. Without the movie, without the book, sometimes these things just get lost. He said, I can get you an artifact. And and the film company, they're done with it. They said, you can have it. We're going to get the cast to sign it. I think some of you guys actually signed it. Except he didn't tell me exactly what it was. And then next thing I know, I get a call from the film studio in Marietta, Georgia. And they said, you can have this item. It's ready. But you have 3 days to get here and pick it up or it gets somebody else wants it. And we're like, oh my God, we want this for the museum, but we can't get down there. And I just remember a friend of mine who I hadn't talked to since like high school, Kathy, is the only person I knew that lived in Marietta, Georgia. And we're friends on Facebook. And I'm like, Kathy, would you mind picking up this thing for me? And I was thinking it was like maybe some medals, you know, some photos or something like that. It was a 250-pound bomb. And all I get is a text from her that said, this is why we don't hang out anymore. but she takes it and she brings it home and she's like, it's in my garage. It's not real, is it? You know? And I'm trying to figure out how to get down there. And finally she says, my husband works at UPS and they said that they can package and ship this thing carefully and get it to you. I'm going to go to the UPS store tomorrow. I'll call you from the UPS store. And we'll get it straightened out. And I said, great. So she lugs this bomb into the UPS store. And the UPS store actually sent me like the security film of her dragging this like 250-pound bomb into the store. And she gets to the counter and she said, can we call Chris and we're gonna get this shipped? They called me and I said, I don't know who this is. I've never heard of her. And I could hear her in the background going, I'm going to kill him. So. but we did get the bomb. If you can come back outside of the Air Venture time period, you can see that it is signed by the cast. My daughter loves it because it's signed by one of the Jonas Brothers and Glenn Powell, so they're pretty fired up about that. Let me ask, how did it resonate in your families? What do they think of all of this, of the film, the book? You guys coming out here to see. Old war planes and hopefully restoring a preserving a legacy. What are your family? You guys started a Corsair today. What's the general feeling of all of it?
They're really accepting of these experiences. One of my cousins said, this is not normal. And I mean, it's true. I mean, I don't know anybody else in my family that's been on a set, been in a movie, been to a premiere in the United States and in Canada, been to screenings, been to these different things, being able to hang out with Glenn Powell, Jonathan Majors, JD, Rachel, Adam, howling in the Waldorf Astoria at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Oh yeah, I got the bill for that.
So it wasn't normal, but we're accepting because it's creating the legacy all over again for a different generation of people, a different way that people haven't seen how friendships from a time when it was uncommon, was common for them. So they're very appreciative and very excited about being a part of this movie or this legacy.
Tom, how about yourself?
Yeah, I would say, I guess speaking for myself and for my family, I think, the overwhelming feeling or sentiment is, certainly gratitude. I said, in that first meeting with Adam and with Glenn Powell, I remember saying to Glenn that I would rather a movie not be made than if it were to be made, by a team who didn't really sort of care about the integrity of the story and the integrity of the characters. And so as I mentioned before, I think we all just felt so fortunate that this is the team that came together to create this movie. And, I said when I was visiting set, I think it was there in Statesboro, and I just said, you know, I know that this movie will represent sort of the closest that I will ever come to knowing what my father's actual daily experience was like, and what Jesse's experience was like, and what their collective experience as naval aviators was like. And so, and again, to bring that to the screen in such a finely produced, carefully choreographed and filmed and portrayed manner, again, was a gift to us. You know, and I think about, you know, obviously, so my dad passed away in 2017, just a few months after meeting Glenn, in fact, and so he wasn't able, obviously, to visit set or to see the final product. And he was a very humble and understated guy, and he deflected attention, and he would think it's a lot of fuss, you know, those movie premieres, et cetera. He would have sort of shaken his head a bit, but he would genuinely be most pleased that the movie has and is bringing Jesse's story to such a wider audience. You know, Dad lived a long life. He was celebrated more than he ever thought was warranted. You know, but just for Jesse's story and Jesse as a person to be known by so many more people. Again, he was a hero in his own right. That might be the greatest legacy of the film. And again, I think we're all grateful for that.
Well, I think one of the things that's most interesting is Tom and Jesse are still driving people together. And when you look around just this air show, I'm sitting on stage with friends I didn't have before this. You have experiences and friends you didn't have. We have a Navy squadron who stood up and did the right thing to get their Hornet here for Tom and Jesse. And we have Corsair owners and operators that came from miles away all over the country to do the same thing for Tom and Jesse. So even though they're not here with us, they're still driving people together to be friends, and that's quite a legacy for them to have.
And the fact that our families maintain this friendship, you know, 70 years later, you know, again, that means the world to me and to us, and is you know, really important and cherished, and just something that I really, you know, value and I'm so grateful for. And again, it's a legacy that they started so many years ago. And I remember the moment, my dad's funeral after he passed away, I know Jessica and I had the same experience when the priest said, now Tom and Jesse are flying together. Whew. Sorry, it's getting dusty in here, Chris. They're together in heaven, you know, flying together again. Boy, that hit pretty hard, but in the greatest way. So, anyway, important legacy.
Absolutely. Well, I want to make sure, a couple nights ago, we didn't have time for, like, any questions. So I want to make sure I get the audience a chance to ask some questions. We have a text number that is up there. Text away your questions. We'll try to get them out there to you. The one question I have so far that I have to ask is, and it's for Tom and all of you guys, if they ever make a movie about you, who do you want to play you? We'll start with you.
Oh, man, I'm more of a behind-the-scenes guy. that's a tough one. I'm gonna defer and go last, I think.
All right.
I
don't know. All right. Adam?
Easy. Kevin LaRosa.
Oh, man. Good answer. Why did I know you were going to do that?
I don't know. I've gotten a lot of you look like. And I don't know. I say Lawrence Fishburne.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah, I can see that. Tom, how about yourself?
I guess I got to give the easy answer and say I got to go with Glenn since he proved his his mettle by portraying Dad. And he doesn't have the Hudner nose. He's got this, you know, more petite nose than the Hudner nose. But anyway, maybe with a prosthetic, you could play me.
It's back to you.
Oh man, I don't know. I was gonna say it's gotta be an aviator, really. You know, I'm a pilot, so I'm not an actor, so I think aviation. And you know, I'd kind of tip back, unfortunately, to Glenn Powell only because he's a brother of mine, and he's a pilot, and he's an aviator to his core. He literally loves aviation, and he's a lot better looking than me. So he'll do great there. So yeah, I'll go with the Glenn as well, I guess.
I'm just going to stick with Matthew McConaughey. Yeah, I'll just go with that. So,
while you're waiting for some questions, there's some really cool things I was thinking about. You know, devotion was made in a trying time. It was a pandemic, and we kind of forget about that. And the movie was made in a little bit of reverse order, whereas the aerials were shot mostly first, just because of how tough it was to film the movie and all the restrictions. We got sent to the Pacific Northwest. We basically took our fleet of Corsairs and Sky Raiders and the L-39 in the dead of winter. And for the Warbird pilots, that's like exactly what you don't want to do. We picked the worst conditions, snowy, icy, and we brought these aircraft there. But that was what JD wanted. He wanted the aircraft to be seen how they would have operated. And these are not instrument Corsairs. You know, we're VFR. But, you know, here we are in the Pacific Northwest in the Cascade Mountain Range. And there were days where we had to consider de-icing the ramp because we would start the Corsair and the tires would skid on the icy ramp. I mean, it was challenging, but that's why it looked so cool in the movie. We decided to actually put them in the environment that we needed so they looked good on camera.
One of the questions I got is there anything from either Jesse's real life or the book that didn't make the movie that you wish had made the movie?
That's good. Mm. So you?
Well, there's one story that I learned about after I had written the book. Commander Sam Clausel was Jesse's roommate in flight training in Pensacola, and he was going to come here. Fell and broke his leg 2 months ago. He's 100 years old, so it's been a slow recovery. But Sam told a great story that it was Christmas time and the pilots from Pensacola were going to be going home, and he and a couple buddies piled in a car and they were going to California. So it's back when men were men, you know, like we're just going to go to California. And they were going to do this drive, and they went up and they were driving out of town, and there they saw Jesse Brown standing alone at the bus station. And he had his, you know, his sea bag there, and they pulled over and they said, "Jesse, what are you doing?" And he was waiting for the bus back to Hattiesburg, Mississippi. And they said, "Come on in with us." And he fought them for a while. He said, no, I'm fine. And eventually they said, "Get in." And they made him get in. And I think it was about five of them in this car. And they drove and they made this detour and they went up to Mississippi and they dropped Jesse off 5 o'clock in the morning at his house. And Jesse's house was very humble. As Jamal said, they were sharecroppers, and it was humble beyond humble when you study his upbringing. And Jesse brought his friends in, and his mother made them all breakfast. And then they went on their way. And I think that moments like that, stories like that, remind you that a lot of people saw the good in him. And even if they might have had preconceived notions, he was changing people everywhere he went. And those guys came to really love him, and that's ultimately the core of what Tom did. I knew what he did, but that's not why I wrote the book. Who cares? Everybody knows what he did. He crashed his plane. What mattered was, why did he do it? Who was this Jesse Brown? What was so special that you would put yourself behind enemy lines and very likely lose your own life for somebody else? Why? The crash itself was an incredible moment in history. But the why, that justified a book.
That's a great answer. Thank you. One of the questions we have here was, which part of the movie required the most creativity? Was there something that you had to really plan around? Was it the flying scenes or?
For me, it's a testament to JD. I think you'd probably agree. But the sequence where Tom Hunter decides to make, you know, that crash landing. Mm-hmm. JD had an image that this would be a one-take shot, starting from an aerial that shows a wide shot of this Corsair that's, you know, blowing off the missiles and tanks, cleaning up the airframe, and then it transitions to a shot right up to Glenn actually controlling the airplane, stays on Glenn's face as we see the trees and the earth getting closer and closer, briefly pans forward, smacks the earth, we see Glenn get pummeled in this Corsair, get out and follow, you know, Glenn Powell all the way to Jesse. It was, and it's done in the movie as this beautiful, crazy and breathtaking sequence. And that was no easy task. It took every department on the production company. For my side, I can speak on my side. we decided we would do it with the L-39 Cinejet, and I'd start about 500 feet out in a descent with the Corsair. And as he was configuring and starting to throw flaps out, I was also having to slow and put the boards out in the L-39, and I just ruddered in until I put the shot over the camera on the nose of the L-39, literally right above his wing. And my end mark was to put the shot over 2 feet above the left wing tip, at which point it would go to the fake Corsair on set, and a camera would go from the wingtip right into Glenn. So there was three or four different stitch points. I think they were done very, very well. That was a sequence in the movie that required a lot of planning, and it turned out really, really great.
So one of the questions I have for Jamal, it's for your family, is after your trip to Oshkosh and your experience with the Corsair, any future pilot plans? Would any of them like to go and take flying lessons? So there's something to think. I guess it's more of a comment than a question, but
they've been walking around going to NASA, and Boeing is, I think, tomorrow, and you know, some of these other ones. So there may be something to it.
That's awesome. That'd be fantastic. Let's see, we got time. We'll do one last question here. I'm not being rude and like texting my friends. I have the questions coming into my phone. So, let's see here. Let's see. And actually, a question for Jamal, and it was, how do you feel when you walk in and see your grandfather's legacy, you know, preserved in a museum exhibit?
I'm honored. I'm humbled by the generosity of people to really invest in him, the man, and in him, the persona of a hero, and what he brought not only to his squad mates and to the other sailors that were on the ship that have contacted me over the years just out of the blue. It's just really humbling, and I'm very appreciative. My family's appreciative, and you know, it really puts air under our wings to go even further in telling people about Jesse Leroy Brown.
Thank you.
Should we tell about bringing him home, how we're trying?
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. You know way more about it than I do, so go ahead. Is still an attempt.
The movie ends with this sort of cryptic line which says, numerous organizations are still attempting to bring Jesse home. And there is an effort ongoing, and it's born by the movie in a lot of ways. Mr. Smith and certain associates have made a plan to go back to North Korea, and we've figured out where Jesse's remains probably are. And this can kind of just fill in one of the gaps at the end of the movie. You see the Corsairs take off, and they say they're going on a funeral flight. And when I was writing the book, even I didn't know this, I discovered it afterwards, that day the napalm didn't work on Jesse's aircraft. And so they wanted to give him a warrior's funeral, a Viking funeral. It didn't work. The cold temperatures, there were a lot of factors. Well, next the guys were thinking about using iron bombs, and they just couldn't bring themselves to drop an iron bomb on their friend. So they bombed Tom Hudner's aircraft, and we've since found photographs that show what we believe is the bomb pattern. And they never touched Jesse's. And so since then, we've determined that Jesse Brown was 98% likely to have been buried in one of the bomb craters that was next to Tom Hudner's aircraft. That's what happens in Southeast Asia. A lot of times when they find MIA cases, the farmers bury them in the natural grave site. And so with satellite imagery, new imagery that we've sourced, we've pinpointed the mountaintop, we've pinpointed what we think are the former bomb craters, and we've planned a trip back. COVID has really put that on hold because North Korea retreated inward. You know, they weren't telling anybody how they were dealing with COVID. It just exacerbated the situation. But Jesse Brown's remains, we think we know where they are, and we think there's a very good chance that they will come home when the world cools down a little bit.
Thank you for continuing to push that project forward. I think we all agree it'd be an amazing day when Jesse can come home.
I think so too.
So just wrapping up here tonight, I really appreciate you all coming out. I know it's a hot one out there tonight, so I really appreciate you guys sticking with us. Except for Tom, I think you're in the air conditioning, so.
Feels good.
Yeah, you're drinking iced tea, it's cool. But seriously though, thank you too, Tom, for the last minute ability to come on with us tonight. You know, allowing us to preserve your legacy, at least to be a part of preserving that legacy here at the EA Museum with our airplane, with our exhibit, through your storytelling, through your work in aviation Hollywood history as in filming, through the squadrons here that support it, and obviously those ripples are still being felt. There's a Hornet out there with their names on it, and you've got Corsair owners and pilots and ground crew that have come from states away, all for Tom and Jesse. So thank you guys for coming. I hope you are willing to come back to some more episodes throughout the week of our show here.
Could I throw in a shameless plug?
Sure.
It benefits.
We've come this far, let's go. Yeah.
And thank you for everyone who sat here in the heat listening to us tell these stories. It's come back to life. And ultimately, devotion, the greatest legacy of it, are all the things that you mentioned, and the fact that the Korean War has a face now. It has an identity, and we can learn from there. You know, it's like what Tom Hudner said. I wear this for all of them. This movie now represents all of them. And at the same time, what would the movie be without you? So our hats are off to you, ultimately, for making this what it is. And to benefit EAA, we're selling books, of course. Yeah, everybody does that. But the cool thing is, the books tonight have the signature of Captain Tom Hudner. He signed several hundred book plates before his passing. And they were in our office, and I always said, you know, we'll put them out someday. And someday comes, and someday comes. And then we said, you know what? What better time than now? And what better organization than the EAA? So that they can keep that Corsair going, and so that they can keep growing this, and so they can keep bringing everybody here, and so that they can invigorate a new generation, so that someday, 20 years from now, there's still people here. So we have the books tonight with the hand-signed autograph of this great American we've talked about all night, hand-signed by Captain Tom Hudner to benefit EAA.
Well, thank you, and thank you for doing that and donating those books to us. Thank you. Thank you all so much. Thanks for coming out tonight, Tom. Well, I'm sure we'll be talking to you soon. We'll probably have to get on you during football season. Me and Jamal will gang up on you over that. And to the crowd, thank you guys again tonight for being here. We look forward to seeing you throughout the rest of the week. Have a great convention, guys.